Welcome to Crafting Solutions to Conflict, a podcast that will explore ways to preserve harmony and prevent harmful conflict in valued relationships, and also ways to resolve conflict effectively and restore harmony if conflict should occur. I'm your host, Jane Bettel, and my goal is to share a perspective on conflict that is both practical and positive. My guest today is Louise Duncan, and I'm going to ask Louise to describe more fully what TetraMap is all about. My very basic understanding of it is that TetraMap is a learning framework. Louise, hello and welcome.
Thank you. Thanks, Jane. It's great to be invited to be a guest on your podcast, and I'm really looking forward to the interview. And perhaps I can just help by describing what TetraMap is. It's actually a model that uses nature as a metaphor. And you're right in saying it's a learning framework, which encourages groups and individuals to learn more about themselves through an experience that is safe and positive. And I often say, you know, it's learning through laughter. But the metaphor is something that, you know, depersonalizes language and opens up opportunities to see the value of our combined strengths as a group. And we have one firm core message, and that's really important to us, is that people understand that strength lies in valuing differences.
Louise, that is so wonderful. I learned a little bit about TetraMap through the experience that we both had in learning podcasting through the Podcasting Fellowship, round two. And then when I learned a little bit more and saw that core principle, I thought how terrific that is, and in a sense, how unusual. It feels like that's not the way many folks tend to think about differences.
You're absolutely right. And I think it's because that's, you know, we're sort of often polarized in our thinking, black and white, good and bad, war and peace. And what TetraMap does is helps us to unpick that polarized thinking and saying, you may see things very differently to me, and isn't that great? Doesn't that add value to my perspective? So it doesn't polarize people, it doesn't polarize situations. It just gives us this framework to unpick situations and look at things from many different perspectives, actually. And the beauty of using nature as a metaphor is that everybody understands nature. So it doesn't matter whether you're the chief executive or you work on the shop floor dealing with customers, or you're in Africa, America, or New Zealand, as I am, everybody has a connection with nature in some way. And that's the strength of it. It brings the people together through the metaphor, and metaphor makes it easy for people to learn. So there's kind of two things that support each other there. And then from that basis of understanding, you know, our primary, I suppose, question that we ask people to explore is, why are you like that? Which sounds a really simple question, but it's such a great question because it gives people the opportunity to say, well, this is how I am. This is how I like to be approached or not. And these are things that really put me off. And from that, you can see it from, oh, I never really realized he saw it that way. And people start to understand, if I want to get the best out of Bob, I need to approach him that way. But Sally's very different to that, and I need to think about approaching that differently with her. Once people understand that seeing it differently is actually a brilliant thing, then they start to see that it's that message about creating synergy. And we talk about that phrase a lot, and the interdependence of one another.
Wonderful. It just, so many different things seem powerful about self-knowledge and knowledge of the other person. Maybe even before getting to that, it's an awareness that it makes sense to think about what the other person needs to hear from me or the way they need to hear it. Even that idea that we should think that way seems foreign to some people.
Yeah, I guess because I've been involved with TetraMap for a long time, it doesn't to me.
That's a good thing.
Surprised. One of the things I love when you go to a workshop where TetraMap is being shared with people is the laughter and the aha moments that people get. And they laugh at this question. Now I know why you're like that. And that, because they're able to laugh, it turns the irritation into an insight. And rather than being put into a box, this is not a psychometric, by the way, for anybody that's listening to this. It's just an intuitive model, a way of describing differences and preferences. But you're not being put into a box, just like nature doesn't put you into a box. It doesn't say a tree is better than an ocean, or this plant is better than that plant. It says we're all different. And isn't that a great thing? But for nature to work in a sustainable fashion, it does actually need all the elements. So earth is firm, air is clear, water is calm, and fire is bright. And for nature to work in life in general, which people do understand intuitively, we need all four elements. If you think about the growth of a tree, for example, yes, you might plant the seed in the earth, but then for it to grow, it needs water, it needs sunshine, it needs light, it needs oxygen. And it can become really something that's strong, but its firm roots will be embedded further into the ground. But it won't continue to grow unless it gets some of the other elements to help it sustain. And that's how teams develop. And that's mm-hmm. what our message is. Let's make teams structurally sound. And we can use that metaphor to help people imagine the growth of a team from a very small seed or acorn or something like that.
Very good. I want to ask you, since you mentioned it, that you have been involved for a long time, how did you first get involved? And maybe you can just walk us through a little bit of how TetraMap came into being.
Yeah, well, the people who developed the model are a couple from New Zealand, John and Yoshimi Brett. And they sort of have always had a background and interest in nature and sustainability and these kind of things. But Yoshimi was a very skilled facilitator of groups and people learning together. And they used to use sort of other models, and they didn't particularly resonate with them because of this polarizing effect that other models had. So they tried to build something themselves using the things that meant something to them. And obviously, coming from New Zealand, nature is such a key part of where we live. Mm-hmm. So they did that. And then as the model was developing, they came across the work of a gentleman by the name of Buckminster Fuller, who I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
A little bit, but I would love for you to describe his influence on their work for those who are completely unfamiliar.
Well, Buckminster Fuller was a multidisciplinarian, and he described as the planet-friendly genius. But he actually said himself he was not a genius. He was just a tremendous bundle of experiences. And so he wanted to prove all his theories that he had about how to do more with less. That was one of his key messages. How can we do more with less in order for the planet to be sustainable? And one of the books he wrote was called Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth.
Yes.
He was very, very, we're talking in the 20s here, concerned about the future of the planet and knowing that humanity was actually making it unsustainable. So sort of 80 years later, we're still talking about it, but that's a different story. But one of the things that he identified was the strength of the shape called the tetrahedron. And that, for people who are listening to this, may know it as a pyramid, but it's a pyramid only with four sides. So four equal triangles that interconnect, rather than having a traditional pyramid which has a square or oblong bottom. Mm-hmm. And he identified that this was the strongest minimal structure in universe by just these four interconnected triangles. And he's got this term called tensegrity, and it's about the tension between the angles. I'm not academic or a scientist or a physicist, so I can't explain it better than that. But it's about enclosing space, enclosing the maximum amount of space using the minimum amount of resources. And he was most familiar for creating the geodesic dome.
Yes.
And people are familiar with that. And that relies on that same principle, do more with less.
And I like the idea, as I understand it, of the necessity, and you touched upon this already, of the four different sides. It can't be all one, it can't be all the other. And you can't eliminate one of them completely.
Exactly. And in this tetrahedron, all sides are equal and there are no opposites, which is, again, a very different way of looking at the world. You know, I talked about this polarizing yes. thing, black and white, good and bad. With the tetrahedron, there is no opposite. So there is no opposite to good or bad. There's just a different way of looking at things. And that is one of the ways that we help people understand how to explore things from multiple perspectives.
Do you find that you need sometimes to undo a perspective of good and bad, black and white, my way or your way, and they're in opposition because folks are just used to that way of thinking?
We don't do that. They do that for themselves. But the process that we have helps them do that for themselves.
Wonderful. So tell us more about that. Well, maybe I shouldn't jump ahead too far.
That's all right.
Tell us more about how they went from this idea that what they were working with was an ideal and thinking about Buckminster Fuller to creating the model and the framework that they did.
You know, they just spent many years on it, mm-hmm. basically. It became their life's work. And when they, you know, they were introducing it into other facilitators said to them, we would love to have to be able to use your model. And so they thought, well, maybe we can make it available to others, because their mission, really their big picture vision, is to make a difference in the world. It's not about making a massive profit, but it's mm-hmm. making a difference to people. So they thought, well, the best way to scale this is to make it available to other people. And in doing so, other people can then talk about their messages and apply the messages to themselves. So that's how they decided to take it from something that they just used in their own workshops into something which other facilitators can use. And then since then, it's been used all around the world. And so how I first came across it was I attended a little session where we were learning about all sorts of new tools that were out there. And this was one of them that I came across. And it was in 1999. So that's how far back I go.
And at the time, did you have an inkling that it would become such a big part of your life?
Not until the first time I used it. And the first time I used it was with a group. And they were a group of team leaders at Sky Television. And I couldn't believe how the conversation went. Because normally as a facilitator, you know, you'd have a run sheet. We're doing this at 10 o'clock and at 10:30 we do that. And, you know, so-and-so, we're moving on to this topic. But the conversation that was enabled through this process was incredible. And it was like they didn't want to stop talking about it. So in the end, I had to use my intuition as a facilitator and say, this conversation is very important to this group, and almost like throw away my notes about what we were going to do next. And it was great, you know, but that's what you want. You want the group to do the work. That's what the difference between facilitation and training is, I suppose. Facilitation enables the group to take ownership of the process and use it how they want to. So, you know, it's not, we're not giving you something, we're sharing something with you, and then you apply it in your own context.
And I enjoyed your reference to the laughter that people exhibit when they're doing this.
A lot of people get sent on training, don't they, in a corporate context. You're going on this course about communication, or you're going on a course about how to handle conflict, or how to handle difficult people or toxic people in the workplaces is something I see continually advertised. And I think, really? I'm always very interested in not what happens in the training room so much, but how it's used afterwards. So I went back to see them in a few months' time to see how they were getting on. And I was really surprised that they still had all the posters they created up in their workspace. They were still talking about it. They were talking about their types of customers. And it really had had, and this is 6 months down the track, it really had had an impact for that long. And I think because it's simple and easy and memorable, people can learn it in the morning, use it in the afternoon, and keep talking about it for months and years to come.
That is unusual, maybe highly unusual. Just the fact that they still were talking about it, hadn't shelved it, hadn't tick the box of, okay, well, we did that. Now we can go back to our usual way of doing things, which, as you say, there are lots of trainings out there that folks are sent to without a lot of enthusiasm.
Because they owned the process, Jane. That's the thing. They owned it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't about me and I'm giving you an 80-page booklet that tells you how to do things that you'll put in your drawer when you get back and you might refer to it once or twice. We don't do that. We obviously, there is a structure to the process that we facilitate, and we often say, you know, trust the process, it works. And when you consider it's been around for nearly 20 years and now used in about 25 different countries around the world in all contexts and cultures, there's definitely something about this stickability factor that is unusual.
All right.
And I think that's a key factor to its development, really.
Mm-hmm. So how does it work that folks start to think about their, is it personality preferences? Is that the right phrase in terms of I'm kind of an air and water person, or I'm kind of a fire and earth person?
Yeah. Well, then how it works is it's a simple, it's not a, we try to not use the word personality because that's more okay. complex. But we say this is about understanding your preferences in terms of, let's start with communication and behavioral preferences, which we all have. Mm-hmm. There's a simple 10-question multi-choice, forced choice questionnaire, and you identify yourself. This is most like me and this is not like me. So we'll say, for example, do you have a preference for being firm? Do you have a preference for being clear? Do you have a preference for being calm? Or do you have a preference for being bright? And eventually we'll work out what people's preferences are after the 10 questions. It's a simple, you know, mathematical formula. But the thing about it is that we never say you're an earth person, because that would be wrong. You're not. We say that everybody has all four preferences, just in varying degrees. So with our questionnaire, the lowest that you can get in anything is 10. So if air was my lowest preference, I would still have a score of 10 in that. So then as the facilitator, I would say, you know, well, let's, you know, Louise, your lowest preference is air, and Jane, your highest preference is air. So why don't you two talk about each other, and then you'll get to learn a bit more about why you're different and what similarities you have. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's many ways that you can cut that up. But that's the first thing. So it's a simple 10-point questionnaire, and people identify with what's their top one or two preferences. But it is important that we always say, nobody is just one element. You're all four elements.
And is it also true that there are no wrong answers?
Of course, yeah.
And that, even that, as you're describing the contrast between this approach and the more polarized, someone else is a toxic employee, certainly not me, how very different to take away that judgment of this is the way people should be, and are you the way people should be, or do you need to change yourself?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's this thing that we describe called flexing your style. So if I want to get the most out of you, Jane, I might want to approach you in this way. And I would learn that from the understanding that you've given me. That's not to say I'm going to be disingenuous or I'm going to be inauthentic about it. But I understand if you don't have a need for lots of facts and figures and you prefer things presented on a one-page document with a bit of colour that excites you about something, that's a really good understanding for me to help you buy into the project that I need your support on, for example.
Right. And I think I've seen that in some writings on your website and people who've talked about the work they do, even some who become facilitators, that they had that aha moment when they were thinking, okay, wait a minute, I understand this is my personal preference, but if I want that buy-in, it's not that I can do this alone because I need the rest of the team. And if I can figure out how to do better with the rest of the team, well, how great is that?
Of course. And, you know, it's that whole thing about 1 + 1 = 4.
As I said, I was just so pleased to see this idea of strength lies in valuing differences. A lot of people hear the word difference and they think conflict, and immediately add to the word conflict the idea of negative conflict. I don't tend to think that way. Instead, try to think in terms of, well, there's conflict that's creative and helpful, and then there's the negative type. How does that sort of thinking play into TetraMap?
You know, conflict is an interesting one. And, you know, if we think about conflict, usually conflict is a catalyst for change. And people immediately think change is, well, not all people, but often people think change is quite negative. But to help them understand that to make a change happen for good, that conflict actually is really helpful. Conflict is very constructive. It's just the skills that people have around handling conflict that are the difference between positive conflict and it being a bit of a car crash, for example.
Yes.
So, you know, if you think about the skills that sit around conflict and change for good, you need emotional intelligence, number one. You need this thing called psychological safety, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term.
I don't know that term. What is that about?
Okay, well, I'll tell you that in a moment. And, you know, you need to be able to take things one step at a time and try to lower your barriers of resistance. So all that takes time, and it's about setting context for conflict. So this thing about psychological safety is really something that's about making it safe for people to share their opinion, knowing that it's not going to have a negative impact on how their manager, let's say, might view them,
right,
or their career progression. A great example that I use about conflict, which I think is the most fascinating and psychological safety, is, I don't know if you get it in the States, but there's a program here called Air Crash Investigation.
I'm not familiar with it. It may be, but I don't know it.
Right. Okay. Well, it's a very good example, but because there's obviously been an air crash that's happened, and they have the Air Safety Board go out and investigate what actually happened. And very often you'll find that there's been some kind of imbalance in power between the pilot and the co-pilot. Sometimes it's pure mechanical failure, but often not. There's often a human element in there. And it might be that the co-pilot thought, oh, I don't think this is a good time to speak out because the wings are iced up, let's say. I don't think we should be taking off here. But the pilot says, no, come on, we've been sitting on this runway. Our customers are so frustrated. We need to get going. And the co-pilot says, well, you're the pilot. You've got 20 years experience. I only just qualified last week. Right. Who am I to speak out? And it's that's what psychological safety is. So airlines, for example, are a very good example of an industry that's done a lot of training around this. And it's a very hot topic at the moment. And for your listeners, I'd like to refer them to a professor from Harvard called Amy Edmondson, who's written a lot on this topic.
Oh, great.
She's just written a book called The Fearless Organization. So I would really recommend that you look up her work.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for that tip. It seems like that's a particularly dangerous place to lack psychological safety. But I can imagine in a very sort of regular workplace that people could be very concerned about their own future if they stand up, if you will, to the boss. And really, is that the right way to go? Now, is that something that is, and this may just show my lack of understanding at this point about TetraMap, is that something that is typically easier for a person who has a preference but in one area or another, or not necessarily so?
It may be easier for people who just think, I need to just get to the point and I'm going to say what I've got to say and then I'm happy to move on. And others may think, oh, I don't want to be saying this in case I offend somebody. So yes, it may be easier for that person to speak out. But of course, they also need to understand how to frame their point that they're putting across.
Right.
Very often it's the leader, and this is where you get really skillful, good leaders who right at the start of a meeting will say, I need your opinion because it's not the same as mine. And if a leader sets the environment and the context like that to make it safe, I want you to speak out. I don't want you to necessarily agree with me. I want you to challenge me on these things. Then you build that environment of trust. And that's what psychological safety is. It's okay to speak out. I might not agree with you, but I still want to hear and I value your opinion. Is down to really often the leader in the environment. And that's why, when you talk about leadership skills, it fits all around this number one, self-awareness, number two, communication, number three, emotional intelligence. And number four, do they really, really want diversity in their teams? Or is it just a tick-in-the-box exercise?
Right. And or I might call it lip service. We know that's what we're supposed to say, that we want to have that. But we really would prefer everyone to do things the way I'd like them done. And it will be faster and more efficient because I know the right way. So let's do it.
Exactly. And it often is faster and more efficient, but it doesn't always mean it's the right way. And then you have this other topic about employee engagement, and then you go off down another track, you see?
Absolutely.
And if you don't give your opinion, that's the other thing that, very good leaders will say, and if you don't give your opinion, you're actually not contributing to the success of the project. And I think people will then feel totally safe that it's okay to give my opinion. And sometimes it's hard. And again, this is another skill of a leader or convener of a meeting. Say, well, look, Jane, we haven't heard from you yet, but I know you'll have something valuable to contribute. Is there anything you'd like to say? And just inviting the people who are naturally quieter to take their turn and realizing that they're not necessarily going to jump in and interrupt. but they will definitely be thinking about it. So you've got people who do more deep thinking about things. If you think about a typical meeting, you know, let's say it's for 30 minutes or 15 minutes or whatever, it comes to the end and the leader will say, okay, guys, that's been a great meeting. Thanks very much. Off we go. You know?
Right. Yes, very different. Well, I'll ask you just to quickly go through again the idea of the four elements and just maybe a word or two about what they represent and what word we might associate or a couple of words with each of the four elements.
Yeah, of course. Well, the first thing is let's talk about earth. So earth, like a mountain, is firm, bold and sturdy. Earth elements are often confident in the way they walk and talk. And goals, control, achievement, and making risky decisions comes quite easily to them. Then we have air, and air, like the wind, is clear. And these are people that focus on order and logic. They like to think things out. So they plan, they like to listen, time's very important to them, and they think about accuracy and quality. Water, like a lake, is calm. Now, water elements are important in holding families and teams together. Loyal and deeply feeling people, they might be a little bit slower to speak out. They're very patient, but their real desire is for harmony and flow. And then lastly, but no means least, fire, like the sun, is bright. So these people are focused on possibilities. They always love to explore multiple options. There's lots of things going on and they can handle lots of things at one time. And they're people who respond to change as an opportunity to try something new and different. So they have a great sense of fun and often bring a sense of energy into the room in the way they walk, talk, and dress even sometimes.
Wonderful. And as you describe it, it is easier to see how important a little of all of that is to any team. I also enjoyed hearing you talking about trusting the process, that it will work out, even if you walk in the door with an expectation of, oh, I may not have the right combination. And I heard one of your podcast guests talk about that, how he was concerned at first that it's not going to work out. I won't have the right combination. But he did trust the process, and it did work out beautifully.
That's the skill of the facilitator, but the process also makes it very easy to be a great facilitator. It's been tried and tested for many years, and I think it just gives people, even if they've done it before and even if they've done other types of tools like this, all that does is just add to their own level of knowledge and learning and self-awareness. And I think for people to do it together as a team, to be honest with you, Jane, even in our own team, even though we all know TetraMap and we know it very well, when we started working on a project, actually, about a year or so ago, we actually did our own TetraMap thing and we talked about our elemental preferences and where our strengths were lying in those, what differences we had, to help us understand how we could best contribute to the project. So we don't just take it for granted. We refresh our own knowledge and we learn a lot from our facilitators and the clients that we work with too. So it's a continual learning journey. And I suppose that's what's kept me engaged for almost 20 years with it.
That is an amazing testimonial. What a terrific way to conclude our conversation. Where would people contact you? Where would people learn more about TetraMap?
Well, we have our website, which is tetramap.com. And also in the US, we have a distributor who looks after our clients in the US. So you can contact Dan Entwistle, who's based in Orlando, and he'll help you with any inquiries that you've got.
Okay. And we have listeners in Canada and the UK, and they can find folks also through your website?
Yeah, best if they've got an inquiry, just to contact tetramap.com, because we're the international side of the organization and we'll help point them in the right direction.
And as I said, I enjoyed listening to your podcast, even though, as I understand it, it's geared more towards facilitators. It was still quite interesting for someone like me who knows very little.
Well, thank you, Jane. That's really kind of you to say that.
And it's something that folks can find on the website. Is that right?
Yeah, find our podcast on our website, and then you can listen on your own, whichever platform you choose to listen to your podcasts. Okay. And learning from you, Jane, I think your tagline is, it's free to subscribe.
part of the joy for me of being able to do this is some really interesting people who would like to learn more about all sorts of things are not familiar with podcasts. So this is an opportunity for people to find a new avenue for exploring other things. And without it, I wouldn't know a thing about TetraMap. And now I know a good bit more.
Well, thanks so much for the invitation, Jane. It was a real pleasure.
Well, good. Fun for me too.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy the Crafting Solutions to Conflict podcast, please subscribe through one of the major apps or publishing platforms. For those of you who are new to listening to podcasts, here's something you may not know. Subscribing to podcasts is free. Comments or ideas about the podcast? Let me know at dovetailresolutions.com. Until next time, I'm Jane Bettle.